The day before Thanksgiving, I often think of as the quintessential Buddhist holy day, a day to give thanks, a day of gratitude. And I feel that way today. I feel very grateful. And may it be so tomorrow. And may it be so for all of us. Sometimes it comes to us. Sometimes we have to kind of remember the things to be grateful for. And just returning a couple of days ago from a 40-day retreat. And that might have something to do with why I feel such gratitude. Although maybe it's just coincidence. I love Zazen. And I got to do a lot of it over the last 40 days. May we all discover what we love the most. And it may not be Zazen, but whatever it is, or may we discover it and do it without delay. I can tell you a little bit about this retreat, if you like. It was in Crestone, Colorado. And Shoho, my wife, and I did a great road trip out there, stopping at like 4 or 5 different national parks in like 3.5 days. We went through Yosemite, Death Valley, Zion and Bryce Canyon, and many beautiful places. Seems like a long time ago now. The light was different. The air was different then. And then Crestone, Colorado is a exquisite place. Has anyone ever been to Crestone? Oh, you have. Yeah, it's physically spectacular. It's Sangre de Cristo Mountains, and these retreat cabins are near the bottom of these mountains, but near the bottom of these mountains is already 8,000 feet. So the air is thin, and the top of the mountains are like 15,000 big mountains there, and Grand Vista. It's a one side of this enormous valley is this one mountain range, and then it's about 40 miles across to another mountain range. I think it used to be an old lake, and it looks that way. It's totally flat, like a desert, with these huge mountain ranges 40 miles apart. And so it's about, I thought, this looks very much looking out from this mountainside where these cabins were across to the other mountains. It's like when you're on the Santa Cruz Beach and you're looking out at like the mountains behind Monterey, and it's the same distance. So it looks like that, except the water is actually just sand, desert. A big sky, and the season changed while I was there, and so deep snow sometimes. Very beautiful when the snow falls thickly and silently. And there's all these retreat centers. There's in Crestone is about 5 miles long, this town, and very remote town, like many, many miles from any other town. But in this 5 mile town, there's 2 Soto Zen centers, large, like monasteries, in the Suzuki Roshi tradition. There's 3 Nyingma Tibetan centers, 3 Kagyu Tibetan centers, a Bun Tibetan center, 2 Hindu ashrams, 2, maybe 1 Catholic monastery, and maybe more too. Some New Age kind of places. So it's really like a spiritual village, and it kind of creates a kind of energy field there. I don't know if everybody in town is some kind of spiritual practitioner, but I think there's not much else going on there. And I'm really emphasizing like retreat, all of these places, because it's so remote. People, of course, do live there, but people come and do retreat, and the place where I was just one of the places that has cabins called Yeshe Kur Lo, which means the circle of timeless awareness. One of the Tibetan centers, and they have 4 cabins, like maybe the size of this Dokusan building, and on a steep mountainside above a small temple. And there are 2 other, so Shoho and I each had a cabin, and there are 2 other cabins, and those 2 had been in those cabins for like 8 months or something already. So it's kind of like, and totally silent. So it's kind of long-term retreat place. 40 days was short. I was just in and out. And the cabin I was in had no electricity or running water. So I had a little solar charger where you could plug in a flashlight and keep it going without changing the batteries. And the water situation is interesting. You know, you can build a cabin pretty easily, I think, if you don't have electricity and running water. And so the idea was that they would take a truck. Every 2 weeks, they'd bring a truck up the mountain and deliver these 6 gallon jugs of water, 7 6-gallon jugs for 2 weeks. And so several times that happened. And so I really got to know exactly how much water I use. And so basically you're allotted, if you divide it equally, you're allotted 3 gallons a day for cooking, cleaning, and washing, and whatever you want to do. And that was a little bit hard for me. Those 3 gallons seems like a lot if you look at it on a counter, but actually it's not that much. It would have been hard to, like, battle on, you know, one of these black solar showers hanging outside, but in the snow, you know, it basically just freezes. So you could go down to the temple building where no one was really ever there anyway, but each of the 4 cabins had a 1 day a week when you could go and you wouldn't run into anybody else and you could use the hot shower down there. But dishwashing is you really have to, you know, use the same water from each pot and just transfer it from pot to pot and barely rinse them. And a wood stove for heat, which some of you know I like to minimize fuel burning, but there were days when it had to be done. It was way below freezing. But big solar windows, big south-facing windows, so when the sun was out, it got very warm during the day, very cold at night. And air is thin, so just like doing some prostrations or walking around on the mountain, totally out of breath very quickly. And it's very silent. So, as I say, Shoho was there, and we worked out a routine where we would get together for lunch on most days. So we'd alternate cooking lunches, which saved a little fuel, and we got to get together and talk for an hour or so. So it wasn't much contact, and I didn't see another human for 40 days besides Shoho. Or hear anyone, but when we get together, we like to talk a lot, and mostly talk about Dharma, but times we would try writing notes, you know, just to stay, get so, in that kind of environment, you just get really, really present and focused. So we tried a couple of times doing like 5 days where we didn't come together and didn't see each other or talk at all. Which seems like, well, 5 days is like a whole sesshin, but actually in 40 days, 5 days is this tiny, minimal little piece of time. And basically set up a schedule. I think that's kind of what makes a retreat, it seems like, is you set up a boundary of space so you never leave that area, never go beyond that temple. There's a retreat caretaker who you could go out if you wanted to go shopping, but the caretaker would give him a little tip, and he'd bring food and leave it in an area for you. So we didn't go out. And then the schedule, pretty much like our sesshin schedules, like 4 sessions of 2 to 3 hours each, with no days off. Just creates the structure of practice. And I, especially after going through all these national parks, and it's really kind of vacation tour, feeling very relaxed and adventuresome, when suddenly diving into this basic sesshin schedule, it was actually difficult for me. I noticed the first week I was resisting it a lot. Of course, I made it up, right? But this is what I came here to do, so I'm not gonna not do it. So I think sometimes people have a hard time in 7-day sesshins, like we're about to have one. I think the problem is because they're not long enough. After 7 days of this schedule, right around then, is just started settling into it. This is my life, and actually really enjoying it. But it takes a little while, it's really a shift of mode. And also a lot of zazen, also a lot of like ritual, making offerings to Buddhas, would do throughout the day, and I really would getting into that, because if you're not relating to anybody, it's nice to keep a kind of generosity practice going, and the Buddhas are always around, so you can always give to them. You can give them so-called physical things to help get into the spirit of actually giving things, like water, for example. Very precious. I gave them a lot of water, and sometimes would run out. But really, if everything is actually created by mind, what the great vehicle teachings all say, Buddha Dharma. So whether you make offerings physically or mentally created offerings, once you really know that that's the case, that physical and mental is really not different, then they're equally the same in terms of offering. They have the same effect. And the Buddhas understand this too, of course. And I think making offerings to Buddhas is, it serves various functions. It's like, for one thing, it's expressing gratitude. It's also great to make offerings to sentient beings, of course. We're kind of more used to that already, to practice generosity with other people and animals. But making offerings to Buddhas is especially in the Mahayana teachings, is highly praised activity. I think partly because it's this expression of gratitude and remembering that the Buddhas are, we're most grateful to the Buddhas. I mean, I'm grateful to a lot of sentient beings, including all of you. I feel very supported by all of you to do a retreat like this. But the Buddhas are, show us how to be free. So, it's expressing gratitude, but it's also like anything that we're holding on to, we can give it away. Physically or mentally. So it's almost like a dual function. And because that's basically our problem as sentient beings, is we think that we are a limited body and mind, that that we kind of own, and then we have all this stuff that the body and mind owns. We think that, don't we? And that thought is not so much fun. I think it causes a lot of a little difficulty or a lot of difficulty. So we give away our body. We give away our thoughts. We give away our feelings. We give away our possessions. We give everything to the Buddhas. If we do it mentally, sincerely enough, then we don't even have to do it physically. But to do it physically kind of helps us check to see if we're, how sincere we are with the mental. And so it's not so much like a, like, oh, how hard it is to give everything away. It's kind of the opposite. It's like the joy of not being a separate body and mind self that's concerned about its limited destiny and its stuff. And the Buddhas appreciate this. They don't really need anything, of course, but they appreciate that spirit of offering, so they kindly respond, and it's not exactly that we're asking them for anything, because that's not really giving, that would be kind of making a deal. Dogen Zenji, our Japanese founder, has this long essay in his master work called Making Offerings to All Buddhas, where he extensively quotes this sutra where the Buddha is saying, in the past, for over eons and many, many lifetimes, I made offerings to thousands of Buddhas, but I did it with like a little bit of gaining idea, like thinking that like maybe they'll give me a prediction of Buddhahood. And so because of that, they didn't. and it goes on for pages and pages. I'm like, why is Dogen spending all this paper going on and on about how many thousands of Buddhas Shakyamuni Buddha made offerings to? And then finally, after all these lifetimes of offerings, he made offerings to a Buddha without wanting anything in return. And then Buddha gave him a prediction of Buddhahood. And it came true. I also was working with investigating distraction on this retreat. And what I discovered was that now I currently now define distraction as any time that I think something that I'm experiencing is something other than the experiencing of it. Anytime I think that a thought or a feeling or a sensation or a sight or a sound or a Dharma talk, a group of people, anytime that all these are experiences, right? Anytime that I think any of these experiences are something other than the experiencing of them, then I call them distractions. So I confess I'm distracted quite a bit, even on a retreat like this. Even to be like focused one-pointedly on some experience, like following the breath one-pointedly, if I have some sense that this breath is something other than just purely the knowing of it, just awareness itself, then I call it a distraction. Maybe that's kind of like a kind of refined definition of distraction. But it strikes me that I noticed when I'm distracted, which is a lot of the time, like if I think that you're actually out there something other than just pure knowing, it's a little bit painful. That's why I like it as a definition of distraction. It's if I think that you're other than me, the knowing, the awareness, then even just that feeling that you're something other than awareness is slightly painful. Therefore, I don't want to be distracted. I mean, I am a lot, right? And I noticed that when I would think that way, and of course you can go way further than just thinking that you're something other than me, right? Then we can get really into some emotion or thought or situation or experience, any experience that we think is other than the experiencing of it. If we get really into reifying it, which means like solidifying it into something that's happening outside of this all-embracing, all-encompassing, ever-present, inconceivable, ungraspable awareness, then we're a sentient being. And stuck. And a little bit stuck in trying to make the most of it, which means like, let's create a better experience, a more pleasant experience. And then we get a more pleasant experience. It's called samsara. Total misery. Right? Any experience. So, to not be distracted, it helps to be quiet. It helps to be still. It helps to open the heart. It helps to be in the mountains. But at some point I remembered that I was going to give this Dharma talk a couple days after I got back. And I thought, how about a nice theme for this talk would be something that I can explore would be, how do you integrate a retreat and the kind of complexity and busyness of non-retreat? the integration of the mountain and the city. Because you can't just stay in the mountain forever. I mean, you could, but that will be kind of limited if you can't practice off the mountain, right? So I think it's an important topic, and so I especially try to keep it in mind as I left the mountain. And so Shoho, we drove out there, and Shoho is staying for another month because she doesn't want to leave the mountain. So I had to fly back. She'll leave eventually. But so I noticed that when I went down the mountain, there were these other people around. And like there was like to get on like a bus and go to the Denver airport and get some lunch. I couldn't believe this. There was Whole Foods in Denver, and I'd never seen anything like this. It was like a mega store, and everything's like automated. I don't know how they are around here, but it's like you want to order some like noodles. I wanted to order it. You don't talk to a person. You go up to like a touchscreen computer, and you plug in this stuff, and then I'm like, where do I get the noodles? I started asking people. I plugged in my noodle thing here, but like, where are they? Let's go way down there to the other end of the counter, and a person will give them to you. And I thought, this is not the mountain anymore. And so I thought, what is the integration of the mountain and the city here? And people were moving fast. Yeah. And they were, and I thought, this computer noodle ordering thing, it seems like it's about efficiency. And it, I just felt like I'm going from this place where basically my basic job was to chop wood and carry water, literally, and sit a lot and watch the sun cross the sky and the snowfall. One of the early dawns after a heavy snowfall, big mountain lion, like size of like a big dog, came just strutting through the fresh snow right outside my big window, and so it caught my eye because something was moving. It just looked at me. I looked at it, and I just sent a bodhicitta, like I like to do with every animal I see. And but that wasn't happening in Whole Foods. I think the kind of mountain life was based on inefficiency. I mean, you could like run a hose up there or something, or sort of carrying all that water. You could like actually show whose cabin has electricity. Basically, just had a power cord that went like hundreds of yards down the mountain. Like, what if some animal eats through that? But totally inefficient, right? You're not producing anything. You're not trying to get anything done, and everything's like a lot of extra effort, like making all these offerings to Buddhas. It's like if you told somebody in Whole Foods that they might like to do that, they would think you were crazy. We have stuff to do here, like important stuff in the physical world to help others and stuff like this, right? And ourselves. So this contrast of efficiency versus inefficiency was striking, but I was looking for the integration. So what struck me was the integration was like all these different experiences, efficient and inefficient experiences, are all happening in the same space of knowing. I mean, maybe it sounds so obvious, right? I kind of knew that, but it really struck me that that is the integration. That's the supreme integration. It's not like, let's have some method to remind ourselves during the day. We talk about these things too. But to me, that's where I was at. I felt like that's a little bit like more distraction. Without looking for anything, keep being the knowing space, remembering this knowing space of awareness, and then watch how it doesn't change whatsoever on the mountain or in the city. It's exactly the same, but the experiences can get quite different, right? So I think the integration, this would apply also to, you know, we're doing a sesshin coming up here, which I wanted to come back for Rohatsu sesshin, because I never miss him. I think that that's the integration. If we can get in touch with who we really are, our true nature, that which isn't changed, which isn't benefited by a retreat, which isn't harmed by tragedy, this kind of awareness that isn't born and doesn't die, that really is our true nature, and it's not some abstract idea. In fact, it's like the most obvious thing that there is. It's just that we are really into distraction, i.e. experiences. I'm into experiences. Not so into experiencing, because it's not an experience. And yet, that's what's free. Any experience is not actually free. Any experience is, at least according to my take on it, is a little bit of a distraction. Now, things can happen, of course, because it's not like we're in some black space. Sights and sounds and emotions and thoughts and feelings and people and zendos and talks, all these things can arise. They're not necessarily distractions, but thinking that there's something other than the knowing of them is the distraction. So if they're just appearing like a kind of dreamlike show, like play, then it's not necessarily a distraction. And that's, I might say, but we got to take this seriously. There's people suffering. I say, if my understanding of the Buddha's teaching of relieving suffering is, if we relate to them in this non-distracted way, that will take care of the suffering of beings, ours and others. I trust this. And any other types of suffering relief is also great. I think we can do it. It's often distracting. It's okay. Sometimes we're willing, bodhisattvas are willing to be a little bit distracted by helping others. But what they're working on is helping others in a non-distracted way, like without seeing that there are others. It's possible, but it's not easy. That's why the Buddhas go on retreat. So not getting caught up in the differences between mountains and cities, between pleasant and unpleasant, these types of experiences. It's not that they're not happening, but if we're fixated on them, if we're attending, I even feel like attending strongly to an experience, and like engaging in a thought and trying to work out a thought or something, total distraction. I do it all the time, and I confess I'm distracted when I am. Strictly speaking, we don't have to work anything out. The Buddhas aren't working anything out. Still, we can function quite nicely, I think, without attending too strongly to anything other than the space it's happening in. Like today, when the clouds really cover the sky like that, it almost seems like there is no blue sky. But the clouds are just condensation of sky. They're just congealed sky in these locations. And then it looks like the clouds are something other than the sky. called distraction. So we can see these clouds are actually just the sky. There's nothing other than the sky appearing as what we call clouds. Then we can play in the clouds and not be distracted. Any questions? Yes. Yeah, nervous system changes in these different environments, and so I think that's inevitable to think we're going to be in that kind of like, you know, dodging the people in the Whole Foods or the ambulances on the road, and not have like the nervous system be affected. I think that's inevitable coming off the mountain, right? So then that's why this integration that doesn't depend on chaos or calm, right, is what I really trust is the integration. It's the background. It doesn't depend on whether the clouds are like thunderheads or cumulus puffballs, right? It's like they're all just made of sky. And if we keep remembering the sky, and not like theoretically, right, or conceptually, we really have to, in retreat, we get this chance to really be the sky. And it's, you know, it's quite a specific thing. It's not an abstract thing. It's a specific practice, you could even say, of being who we really are and not identifying with the experiences of body and mind, but to identify with the unborn space of awareness which knows the experiences of body and mind. Then the nervous system can be like pummeled around. And it's almost, if we really stay with it, then it's almost kind of fun. Sometimes I like kind of testing it on like the roller coaster at the amusement park. See like what happens to that space, and it's very hard to stay in that space when you're going downhill. But That's part of the integration, to get really trust the space of our true nature, of ever-present, unchanging knowing. And that way we really get to see the contrast of when the experiences change a lot, like really painful or really pleasant. By the way, these are the two. When they're really painful and really pleasant experiences, that's when it's the hardest to remember our true nature. Because the experience is so overwhelming. We're so drawn into the, like if you're watching a movie, the movie's really dramatic, we're going to forget that we're watching the screen. But if we're just like, if it's just a still landscape with a person walking in the distance very slowly, this is it. It's really much easier to stay in touch with it. It's a movie screen that's taking these different forms. So that's why if we do retreat and get more and more familiar with the background awareness, then when the foreground experiences get more and more dramatic, we can maybe still remember. Like, I just notice how it's already, after a couple of days of being out of there, and it's already more challenging. But it's different than it was before I left. So I think there's a training that can happen. It's not like we just get thrown away at the end of the retreat and we just have to do it again right away. It's hopefully there is an ongoing deepening. And I feel also another insight from this retreat is the more I practice, the more both that I want to practice and the more I feel like I need to practice. Strangely. You might think, the more you practice, the more you think, like, now I can take a break. I've gotten to where I wanted to get. At least for me, it seems to be the opposite. The more, that's the longest time I've ever done something like that. And kind of feel like I need to do that longer. For the benefit of all beings. We don't want to make this just about our own liberation. I more and more feel like that's how my understanding of how the Buddhas are recommending that we benefit beings. The Bodhisattva vow, thus, that's the way they seem to have practiced. Maybe not all of them, but pretty much. So, yes. You have a question? Oh. Yes.
Do you actually want to ask a question, Smith?
Well, like I said, we got for lunch, we got together and we alternated cooking lunches so we could make an offering to sentient beings as well as Buddhas. And mostly we would get together for lunch. Except for these, a couple 5-day periods where we just wanted to focus even more silently and not distract each other so much by having lunch together. It is very interesting to do this as a couple, this kind of thing, and how to arrange that. I mean, there's no way we could have done it in one cabin because we're doing a little different practices too. But very supportive. You know, to have another person where that you're familiar with and that you really feel encouraged by their practice. And be practicing together like that. Even the 5-day periods where we couldn't quite see or hear the other cabin, but it wasn't that far a walk between. But knowing, oh, this other person is totally engaged right now too. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of contrived and artificial, right, to set up these kind of like boundaries of space and silence and time. But it is. It's kind of, those are kind of experiences. So they're kind of distractions from this, strictly speaking, to set up a retreat with these boundaries and schedule is a little bit of a distraction if we're kind of getting into like, I gotta keep the schedule and I gotta, you know, treating it as some objective, something outside of the ever-present knowing of experience. But it helps to get in touch with who we are. Yes. The rush and the noise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's partly like one way it's useful, I think, is just sort of as a test to see that, like, if I'm really working with these mountains and clouds and snow, and lions are actually just the knowing of them. There's no separation. And if I can't bring that into the kind of chaos, then it's kind of contrived and artificial. So it kind of tests to see, like, can I still remember the basic practice that's exactly the same when the movie is getting really intense. And so in that way, I think it's actually useful. And people like Haku and Zenji was really into this, right? He's like, had all the monks doing sesshin after sesshin. And then when they were pretty steeped in it, he said, now we're going to get on horses, backwards on the horses, blindfolded, and a kind of wild, rambunctious horses, and go through a really busy marketplace to kind of like test. So I think there's like the test factor, and is, you could say, part of the usefulness, but also for our own benefit, I think. But the other part of the usefulness is that's where beings are mostly suffering. Other people and the animals are mostly suffering in these condensed, dense areas of human activity, like cities. And so we can benefit others, we can help others just by being around them, just by like being in those situations and trying to keep the practice and not be distracted, which is hard. I think sometimes if we feel like we just get sucked back into distraction too easily, then like that's what Hakuin Zenji himself said, is like, I really like feel like Buddha is just on Buddha in sesshin, but when I basically just cook lunch, I'm already like totally not Buddha. This is after he was practicing many years, and he's like, I really, and he was very honest with himself and felt like, I have to work on this integration. And so at the end of his life, he said, practice in the midst of chaos and busyness is the supreme practice. But to start that way, I think, at least for him and for most people, I think it's not going to work, even depending on our past lives, maybe we could do it, but most of us need a lot of stillness, because it's so subtle. This awareness is like the most obvious, but the most subtle, because it's not an object, it's not an experience. Between the experience and the experiencing. Yeah, I think if we're making it a value distinction, even to say that just resting in the nature of awareness is better than being in the chaos, that would be called a distraction. We really have to see again, not that somehow we're removed, but again, this definition of distraction that I'm working with now is to think that the experience is something other than the experiencing of it. So there can be stuff happening, and that shift can happen very fluidly once we get used to it. In fact, it's kind of nice And we're really in this spacious awareness and knowing that's who we are, and it's, of course, it's more joyful and peaceful and relaxed to kind of break it, to kind of like, okay, let's jump up and make lunch now, just to see if we can do these transitions, like come into it, come out of it, and which is, again, a little bit artificial, but experientially, it is, like, it's not an, again, not an abstract thing. When we're in it, we know we're in it. There is a knowing that this is it, and we're out of it. We get familiar with, I know I'm not in it. Again, that's kind of an artificial distinction, but it's just, we just know how, what we're identified with. We're constantly either identified with the experiences of a body and a mind and the senses, internally and externally, or we're identified with this space of knowing that's not inside or outside or in between, that has a center or edges. And we can tell. Yeah. Yeah, and I think another useful thing about just the contrast between like the so-called mountain and the city is what really struck me is that, like, especially attending to that which is exactly the same for both, which is what I'm saying is the integration, attending, being that which does not change from the mountain to the city, but noticing the changes in the appearance. It was really clear to me that this realm of appearance is created by karma. It really struck me how, like, this Whole Foods with all this efficiency and all the people who built this city, this is just like this congealing of human karma, which is just intention. A bunch of human intention wanted to create that. That's it. Me coming from the mountain and be like, why did people want to do this? Why wouldn't they want to just be in the mountains? But people wanted to. That's called karma. And so they did. And in the mountains, there was not a lot less people. And there was this kind of, like I said, this spiritual village. And it was so, it felt like a pure land. Like that humans, with their karma, built these cabins just for people to do retreat and keep the cost really low. And they keep it really simple. So people can come and do this, and they just offer it to everybody. There's some places that are like closed retreat places, like Pema Chodron was in the next valley over from me, and the place where she practices, they're a little bit more, just more strict because they don't want this, because it's a little more group thing, whereas this is individual practice. So it just struck me that. That's part of it too, is recognizing who we are, being who we are, this nature of ever-present sky-like knowing in which any kind of cloud can form out of that. And then really working with the clouds. Almost you could say the ultimate practice of just being the sky and the relative practice of actually like aligning the clouds with the sky. Basically aligning everything we do in our life with this vision of reality. That's actually, in a way, harder, I think, than, in some ways, harder than just being the sky. I don't know, harder, easy, but almost like two different aspects, and not really two, but kind of two things you can work on. And the Buddhas say that, like Nagarjuna tells a story that, like, the gathering of positive energy and virtue and like giving and ethics and patience and diligence and concentration are kind of relative appearing practices and experiences. They're a little bit dreamlike, but that's what creates the form body of the Buddha. And then there's the other practice of Prajnaparamita that's like creates a Dharmakaya of a Buddha. And in the Mahayana, we need both. You don't just have a Dharmakaya that's like, well, whatever, however the appearance shows up, it doesn't matter because it's all a dream. No. In a way, you emphasize more the Dharmakaya because that's the true reality. And then you integrate the dream to align with that. So everything in our life is like in accord with our deepest understanding and deepest truth. That's kind of hard sometimes because our habits are strong. So you can see cities are just, they're not like somebody, group of people get together and say, let's build a Whole Foods like this. And in a way, we do create specific things like that, but it's this kind of unconscious collective thing. And can we make it more and more conscious how we are creating our cities and mountain villages today is also the day that Soto Zen celebrates the birthday of Keizan Zenji. We don't really do any special ceremony, but one of our great Zen ancestors tonight dedicate the merit of our talk to Keizan Zenji. May his transmission of light continue endlessly and to all sentient beings lost in the chaos of efficiency. May they remember what's most important. And to all those on Thanksgiving, may we all remember what we're most grateful for. Beings are numberless. I vow to keep them. The illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.